But one of the things I want to discuss is thermodynamics and black holes. So for that, I'm going to need a little bit more machinery, because in order to talk about thermodynamics, I'm going to do this via a Euclidean approach. Now, I think you might have already seen a sort of hint of that, but in terms of periodicity of the Schwarzschild solution in its analytic continuation to Euclidean time. But to actually talk more broadly about thermodynamics, we're going to want to sort of look at actions or the partition function in gravity. Now, to do that, I need to know what the action for gravity is. And again, I understand you've at least seen this, you know, at some level already. But what I want to do, what you find when you try and do this action prescription, is that the action itself, just the simple thing that we're going to discuss mostly today, the Lagrangian, isn't quite enough when gravity's concerned. So we end up having to add boundary terms. So today we'll talk about actions, and I'm going to kind of use as an example a solution of Einstein gravity with a scalar field. So we're going to go back again and think about solutions. And then tomorrow I'll talk about boundary terms, and then on Thursday we'll do thermodynamics. So I'm under orders to do thermodynamics before Friday because of your homework or something. Apparently. Okay, so it's useful. Actually, also, I was asked quite a good question last Friday, that when I say somebody noticed that I sort of said Einstein gravity and said, well, why? Why do you say Einstein gravity? What's specific about that? And so we'll see, you know, as I write down the Lagrangian, Einstein gravity is just general relativity, okay? And so I'll try, although I'll be coming back to it later in the course, I'll sort of give a couple of pointers about what I mean when we get to writing down the action. So Lagrangian is really just a local kind of density function of whatever your dynamical variables are, and it's a useful way in which we encode what our dynamics actually is. And in pretty much everything we do, in high energy physics at least, we tend to have an action or Lagrangian description. There's just one exception, at least I'm aware of. But that doesn't mean that absolutely all physics has an action. It's just that most of what we tend to see in high energy theoretical physics does. So to get an action, we integrate a Lagrangian, which means we need to be able to integrate on our manifold. So of course, we just have to think about what does it mean to integrate on the manifold. We can't just use d4x, because that's not an invariant. This is just a coordinate volume. And what we do instead, our invariant measure for our manifold for integration is root g d4x. So I've put it explicitly there, but usually we just write root g for shorthand. And so that is an invariant under general coordinate transformations. And we can sort of recognize it as, if you like, the dual of the four form, the volume four form. So if we vary this volume element, again, this is partly revision, we have to vary, we need the expression for the variation of the determinant of a metric. And so we use an expression that the, yep? So in this case, this is a four form, right? And so when we kind of write this thing here, we're sort of thinking of it more as just like the scalar part, yeah? So, but, I mean, I know people, all, you know, you can also do an, I mean, I guess strictly you're integrating over forms, but typically this is the language that we use most of the time, okay? So if I use this expression for the determinant of the metric, then the variation of an exponential is just the exponential times the variation of the exponent, which is trace log g. And of course, delta of log is simply g inverse delta g. And so we trace that. So that's our variation of the metric. And so we see that varying root g just gives us a factor of the metric or inverse metric. So why have I taken that particular variation? Well, the reason is that the metric is kind of our physical observable. There's 9 a.m. for you, in general relativity. So what do we physically mean when we think about a manifold? What are we doing typically if we just look at the space-time around us? Well, we're kind of experiencing time intervals and seeing distance intervals. So what we're really doing is thinking about distance, be it space-like or time-like distances. So g is our physical variable as far as gravity is concerned. And so if we think about a Lagrangian approach, typically it's a variational approach, and normally what we do is we take our action and vary it with respect to our dynamical fields. So we're going to take the Einstein action and vary it with respect to the metric. So that was why I was doing that there. So just to see how this works, if we imagine we have a massless scalar field that's somehow potentially interacting with gravity, then our scalar field typically has a Lagrangian, which is just, if it's massless, just the kinetic term, half d phi squared times our volume measure. And then if I vary that, I get a piece that looks like d phi d delta phi. And a piece that has the variation of the metric in it. And so we know how to handle that. The first term we integrate by parts. So we see that the functional derivative of s with s phi with respect to phi is just this combination of the partial derivative or partial divergence of root g d mu phi, but then we say we recognize that as the wave operator because the derivative of root g over root g is just the gamma Levi-Civita symbol. So presumably this is an identity that you've seen. Blank. Have you seen this or not? Yep. And then if I look at what the variation of S with respect to G is, sorry, there should have been a half in there. This is what I get. So we see that the first term is nothing other than the equation of motion that we'd expect for a massless scalar, the wave operator acting on phi equals zero. And the second relation we recognize as the energy momentum tensor for phi. So our variational principle acting on just S phi gives us the equation of motion for phi and its energy momentum tensor. So of course that box does actually contain information about the curve manifold. If that's on a curve manifold, it's the curved space wave operator. So that's just looking at the scalar field part of the action. So now for gravity, a natural scalar is just the Ricci scalar. So we would say that our gravitational action would be the integral of r root g d4x. So we can see that varying with respect to the inverse metric would give us minus a half r g mu nu. So we can kind of see that's a sensible thing to do. So to just cross-check or just revise about why this works, our Ricci scalar is the trace of the Ricci tensor. So it's the Ricci tensor contracted with the inverse metric. So delta r is r mu nu delta g inverse. So the first of those terms, r mu nu delta g mu nu, this is good because it contributes to the Einstein tensor. And then the second term, I just have to, I mean, I know I don't want it there because I know I've already got my Einstein tensor, but I have to make sure that that doesn't give me any further corrections to the field equations, the gravitational field equations. So to get r mu nu, delta r mu nu, we're going to, it's called Palatini lemma, I believe. We're going to use a special coordinate system. So one of the things that we always say about the connection is, of course, it's not a tensor. It's dependent on your choice of coordinates. And the other thing that we think of about a manifold is that a manifold is locally like flat space. So as long as you zoom in close enough, our manifold looks flat. So putting those two pieces of information together, that tells us that we should always be able to choose coordinates locally such that our connection coefficients vanish. So we're sort of saying that we can choose coordinates to make gamma equal to zero. Now, strictly, we can only make gamma vanish at an individual point, but it's always very small in the region of that point. So this is this notion of normal coordinates. So normal coordinates are saying that the the connection components vanish at least at a point. The only thing to remember is that sort of d gamma or derivatives of gamma, they don't vanish, don't necessarily vanish at the point. So the idea is that gamma is zero, but Riemann, which is a physical quantity, is not necessarily zero, therefore d gamma is not necessarily zero. So here, this is telling us that our first derivatives of g vanish in this coordinate system. But not second derivatives. So that's the idea. It's a local inertial frame. That's what we would call it. Okay. So our Ricci tensor is simply the trace of the Riemann tensor on the first and third indices. Once again, now that we're actually having to do, you know, honest-to-God calculations, we go back to abstract index notation. So our delta R is going to be the variation of that trace. So now I write down what the trace is. And in normal coordinates, my gamma vanishes, and the Riemann tensor is sort of schematically, it's d gamma plus gamma gamma. So when I vary it, my delta gamma may not be zero, but when I take delta of gamma gamma, then that is zero in the normal coordinate system. But the first piece, the variation of d gamma, well, d gamma is not zero anyway in the normal coordinate system, so I must take the variation of d gamma. Now, of course, we know delta of a connection is a tensor. So, you know, what I've written down here, I could automatically take to a covariant. So remember, comma is a partial derivative, semicolon is a covariant derivative. In normal coordinates, because the connection vanishes, partial differentiation and covariant differentiation are the same. So this, in normal coordinates, these two are equal. So I now have an expression for delta R mu nu, which is geometrically sort of invariant, geometrically a sensible definition. It's simply saying take the connection, take the variation of the connection and the anti-symmetrized covariant derivative.
Why is the first term symmetric in mu and nu? Shouldn't there be a symmetrization? Or is it already symmetric?
Have I screwed up my indices? Which one?
The first term on the right hand side, yeah.
This one? So,
yeah. Why is it symmetric in mu and nu?
So, okay, that's because if you look at what the trace of gamma, you know, gamma, the trace of the connection, that's just the derivative of root g. So this is kind of like the second derivative of root g. So it's, It's not explicitly symmetric, but I think it is symmetric in the metric connection. Yeah. Because for sure you don't symmetrize on that when you write down the Riemann tensor. So all we need to do now is to calculate delta gamma, and that's reasonably straightforward. So because the first derivative of the metric vanishes in normal coordinates, I don't pick up a derivative of the inverse metric sitting in front of all those derivatives of G. And all I pick up are the derivatives of G themselves. So again, in normal coordinates, this is, I can change my partial derivative to a covariant derivative. And so I get, it's a half G mu sigma grad lambda delta G sigma nu plus grad nu delta G sigma lambda minus grad sigma delta G nu lambda. So notice at the moment, I've just written it in terms of the variation of the metric, not the inverse metric, which is what's happened, you know, what I'm actually varying my action with respect to. So that means I can insert this expression for delta gamma into this expression for delta r. I can then take the trace using the inverse metric to find out what this second piece is in the variation of the Ricci scalar. So that's what delta r mu nu is in terms of varying with respect to g. And now I want to convert that. Yep.
What do you mean when you write delta g with one index up and one index down?
So this is here, this is g mu sigma, delta g sigma nu. Okay? And it's coming from pulling this one through here. But that was why I just said this is with respect to delta of g, not delta g inverse. So what we want is to vary with respect to g inverse and not g. And essentially all that does is give you a minus sign. Yep. No, I'm just saying that when I've gone through calculating the variation of the Ricci tensor, the natural thing to do is to calculate it with respect to a variation of G. But because G inverse is the identity to linear order, the variation of G inverse is essentially minus the variation of G up to raising and lowering indices. So that, which is what I just wrote there.
So but in that step, when you vary with respect to G, you're
I don't need to because it's normal coordinates. The first step was in normal coordinates. I don't need to worry about the variation of G inverse because in normal coordinates, the first derivative of G vanishes. So all I have to do is vary the dGs inside the bracket because they won't vanish. Yep.
I see that when you take the variation of the Ricci scalar, the first term, it's going to contribute with the square root of G term to make the eigenstate appear. But if you took the variation in respect to G mu nu downstairs, then you would get a plus instead of a minus, right?
So yes, but then then you would also get delta G inverse is minus delta G. So you'd also get a minus in front of the R with the indices upstairs. So both of them flip sign, yep. And then, of course, what I've written down in terms of the variation of phi, that would flip sign as well. So everything would just flip sign. It's just, I guess it's more convenient to vary with respect to G inverse. So that's another question we're doing well for question two.
I think there was an issue with the indices in the first line.
Quite possibly. I might well have.
I think Lyra and you.
I have to admit, I'm not 100% awake this morning, and I agree with you. I can see there's an issue here. So my guess, therefore, is that, oh dear, what should this be? No, that's okay. Grad mu, grad lambda. G lambda nu. There we go. See if that was. No, what's happened? Have I? Yep. Let's see. Okay, where's it coming from? It's coming from here. So that's d lambda.
I think
Yes, that's right. That's what I've done. I think I've just transported that thing. Yes, you're right. I'm pretty sure that's what I've done wrong. So I know that it should be the outer derivatives here. So this one should probably. That's okay. That's okay. And I think those are now okay. Yeah, I think what I've done is I've just transported it over from the previous line without realizing that I should have swapped lambda and mu. So if I do this flipping of sign, and then I'm tracing over mu and nu, these first two terms, they're just symmetrized under mu and nu. And these last two terms also give me the same combination, which is box of delta G, the trace of delta G. So I get. I get a second derivative of my metric and a derivative of the trace of the variation of the metric. Now, this is what we normally say. This is a total derivative. And so we say, okay, if it's a total derivative, when I do my Lagrangian formalism, I don't get anything dynamical. I get a boundary term. So therefore, we identify our gravitational action, our Einstein-Hilbert action, as the integral of r root g. And then if we look at what we get when we add in matter, such as a massless scalar field, if I look at the variation of this Lagrangian with respect to g inverse, I get a half t mu nu. And since I want my Einstein equations to be Einstein tensor as 8 pi g t, I know I have to add in a constant of minus 1 over 16 pi g in front of this action. So this tells me that the functional derivative of the Einstein-Hilbert action is my Einstein tensor divided by 16 pi g, so that when I vary everything, the full Lagrangian, I get the Einstein equations. So when I say Einstein gravity, this is exactly what I mean, that the gravitational action, the action that's telling us about the dynamics of the metric, or our gravitational observable field, is just r root g. So this is Einstein gravity. So examples of things that would not be Einstein gravity would be if you coupled r root g to a scalar, maybe putting some scalar in front of it, if you added higher derivatives, so in other words, combinations of like r squared, r mu nu squared, etc. These are examples where you would be going beyond Einstein gravity. Mm-hmm. I've got two of you now.
So how can we be sure this is really a surface term? Because it's in a covariant divergence.
Yeah, but it's the same thing that tells you there that the wave operator is 1 over root g partial derivative. In this case, we've got up there, I've written a divergence, but when you put that back in the action, you've got a root g. The divergence is equal to 1 over root g d root g whatever, right? So that's how it turns into a partial derivative, which you then integrate up to give a boundary term. Sorry? You had the same question, yeah.
When we were studying EDS and we saw that, for example, the boundary actually had some influence over the evolution, mm-hmm. wouldn't this case, for example, this boundary term influence the dynamics?
Ah, well, we're going to come back to that tomorrow. Now, if we're just doing a variational principle, the boundary term doesn't actually come in and give us something in terms of the bulk, but what we're heading towards for Thursday, is actually seeing how, because this boundary term, as you see, has derivatives of delta g in it. Now, normally, when you do a variational principle, you say, I allow phi to vary as much as I want inside my box, but on the edge of the box, delta phi has to be zero. And the idea would be that we would do the same for the metric. I would allow delta g to vary as much as I want inside my box, but on the boundary, delta g would be zero. But I can have delta g equals zero on the boundary and that boundary term not vanishing. So that's why I've kind of flagged it up, because what we're going to be trying to do is to properly take account of that boundary term. So that's what we'll be doing tomorrow. But yes, you're quite right, you know, to sort of to have focused in on this boundary term. And it is, there is an issue with the boundary term. We do have to deal with it. We are going to deal with it. Okay? And indeed, there is an instance where the boundary could interact back with the bulk. And that is when the boundary is an actual object, physical sort of you know, some sort of physical object that we can, we maybe expect to have in a theory. So that's what I'm about to discuss now. (clears throat) So to some extent, I'm doing this as an example of, you know, how our Lagrangian description gives us equations of motion, how we sort of combine normal fields with gravity. So in part, it's to kind of illustrate what I've been talking about. But also, this example is looking at other sorts of solutions that we can write down or do a lot with analytically in gravity that are not just black holes, cosmology, or weak field. Okay? So our scalar Lagrangian, we're going to add an interaction term now, where V of phi is a double well potential. So here, V has two global minima, and that is at phi equals plus or minus eta. And our phi equation of motion sort of takes into account the fact that you have this non-trivial potential. So what I first want to do is just to explore this in the context of, you know, just the scalar field. And you've done spontaneous symmetry breaking and field theory, yeah. So you'll be recognizing this. So you kind of know how to handle this thing in the context of field theory. So in the context of field theory, you always pick a vacuum and you quantize around the vacuum. And so the reason this is called spontaneous symmetry breaking is here our potential has a symmetry, a Z2 symmetry, flip the potential around the y-axis. But when we pick a vacuum, we have to go to one side or the other. And our vacuum state is no longer symmetric under that Z2 choice. So what you do, typically, you quantize around one of these vacua and you find, gee, I've got a massive particle. I have a massive excitation sitting around one of the vacua. But there's something else that can happen. And that is something that's non-perturbative. So what we can imagine, or we can look for a solution in which to the left side of the room, phi is in the minus vacuum, and to the right side of the room, phi is in the plus vacuum, and see if we can make sense of that particular setup. So I'm going to let my coordinate across the board be z. And if I look at my equation of motion, then if I ask what is that equation of motion if I were in flat space-time, then that would tell me that phi double primed was equal to 2 lambda phi squared minus eta squared. That's my equation of motion. Now that actually has a solution. Which is a tanh. So I have a profile for my scalar field such that at one end it tends to minus eta, and at the other end, it tends to eta. So if I check, if you go and check, you'll see that phi double primed is indeed equal to 2 lambda phi, phi squared minus eta squared. So just write down phi prime because I do need it. So if I sketch my profile for phi, it simply, it sits at the vacuum for a while, and then it has a relatively rapid transition to the other vacuum. And this is the distance, if you like, the width of this transition is set by 1 over root lambda eta. And if you actually quantize this theory around this vacuum, you'll see that root lambda eta is kind of the mass of the excitation around the vacuum. So the scale, the width of this solution is sort of set by the mass of the scalar particle. So this is known as the kink, and it's a valid background solution. It's stable because if we wanted to try to get rid of it, we'd have to lift the scalar field from one vacuum to the other over an infinite region of space. So it's actually a stable background, and it's stable because of the topology, if you like, the fact that these vacuums are disconnected. They're in separate values of phi. So we call this, if we imagine that we're in four space-time dimensions, this thing depends on only one direction. It's a profile just in one transverse direction. So it's extended in two directions. And so it's called the domain wall. And we typically use the phrase domain wall to mean any solution that kind of interpolates between one vacuum and another vacuum in our theory. So that's what the domain wall is. And let's just try and think about what it does. Our energy momentum, we know how to find that because we calculated what it was. So that's just d mu phi minus a half trace of d phi times g. Oh, minus v. Because this is an interacting scalar field. So that was why I wrote down what phi primed was. So if I look at the z component of t, tzz, I get phi primed here, phi prime squared, minus a half phi prime squared, plus v. And I think that should be minus v for some reason. Sorry, yes, it is minus v, because gzz is negative. And t naught naught is a half phi prime squared plus v. And I get the same thing if I look in the other two directions. So these are the non-zero components of the energy momentum tensor. So what is this actually? Well, phi prime squared, oops, if I look at my phi prime, let me just shift it to z equals z naught for making it easy. Phi prime squared is just proportional to the inverse hyperbolic cosine, and it turns out that's actually the same as v at this level. So this tells me that my energy momentum tensor, we call it alpha beta, has simply got components parallel to this wall. So this is strongly localized. If I look at my sech to the fourth function, it's very strongly peaked. So what I've constructed is a solution that represents what we would think of as some sort of, it's almost like a rubber sheet. It's something that's pretty localized. You know, it has a fairly sharp localization, very well defined, and it has energy momentum. So if we think about Einstein gravity, we would expect that this would have some gravitational effect. Now, one of the things that might worry you, though, is that it's localized on the wall. If I integrate T naught naught, let me just integrate with respect to Z first, I get a finite answer, but my wall has infinite area. So I should worry, or normally if you have an object that's infinitely massive, because it's infinite in size, you might worry that when you couple in Einstein gravity, you're going to end up in trouble. So this is why I think this is one of these useful examples to think about, because gravity is sometimes a little strange. And in this case, although naively you'd think, looking at a flat space solution, hey, it's got infinite energy, I should be in infinite trouble, gravity actually cuts things off, and gravity makes it okay. Yep.
Is this some kind of relation to dark matter? Dark energy, because it has this minus one equation of state.
Yeah. So people have tried to use things like this to explain dark energy, but of course it's only parallel to the wall, and so therefore they talk about walls in five dimensions, where we live in this, in the wall. So. So let's add in gravity and see what happens. So notice that in the directions parallel to the wall, my stress tensor is just proportional to the metric. So this is sort of suggesting to us cosmological constant, in fact, as kind of was what was behind that question. So that's sort of suggesting that we look for a constant curvature space parallel to the wall. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write that down. I'm going to write down a constant curvature space in the directions of the wall and have some transverse direction, the z direction, and see what I get for my curvature. And then I'm going to solve the Einstein equations and see what happens, see if I can without getting a singularity. So this is my proposal for the metric. Nothing depends really in any significant way on the parallel coordinates, so this is going to be a constant curvature space. And we just get some, we could possibly have a Z dependence multiplying it. So I'm going to very quickly use that Cartan formalism to derive the curvature of this metric. But I'm just going to be slightly more general, and I'm claiming here I'm going to take it in an arbitrary number of dimensions, and I'm going to assume that gamma is a D minus one dimensional metric dependent only on the D minus one coordinates. So that's sort of going to be the supposition. So my orthonormal basis, dz, is obviously just the one corresponding to z. And then my other orthonormal basis, I simply take the orthonormal basis with respect to gamma and multiply by A. So that's my orthonormal basis there. I do my exterior differentiation. Get nothing from dz. For the other one, I take a derivative of A. I get an A primed on A piece. And then when I take the derivative of the orthonormal basis with respect to gamma, I get whatever the background connection is of gamma. So that allows me to read off the connection. I can see that I've got the AB connection is just directly imported from gamma, but just to note that's in that omega naught basis. And then the connection component with a Z in it is just A primed on A. So I now differentiate again. My RAB is going to be D of theta naught, then I've got theta wedge theta. And so the only theta wedge theta pieces I get come from the theta AZ pieces. Sorry. Got these terms, of course. So the first piece you can see is just building up the background, two forms, the curvature of the gamma metric, and the second piece is just A primed on A squared. So you see that if I build a space-time, which is some lower dimensional space times a factor function dependent on an extra coordinate, my curvature is like the lower dimensional curvature plus a piece that's dependent on how this function A varies. Sorry, I remember you can't see that if I put it too high initially. And then if I look at the z term, I've got, if theta az is just a prime times the background basis element, omega naught, and so I get an a double primed, and then I've got to differentiate the background, omega naught, and then finally, I've got to take the theta wedge theta pieces. And so from this, I can read off my Riemann components in the orthonormal basis. So the reason I've got that 1 over a squared there is, remember, this is all with respect to the omega naught basis. In order to take omega naught to the my basis of my spacetime, I have to multiply or divide by a factor of a. So this allows me to read off my Riemann tensor. So notice that although, you know, we've sort of sat there and done summation, I've nowhere used the fact that we're in an arbitrary dimensional space in terms of gamma, and I'm not really worried about the explicit structure of gamma. So this is a somewhat different example of Cartan than when we did the spherically symmetric space. But again, if you think about what gamma could be, all I've said is gamma is a lower dimensional metric. And so I've managed to calculate a curvature tensor there. I mean, admittedly, I haven't calculated this thing. But without actually, or with absolute minimal effort, I've managed to sort of say, well, it's composite space-time. I've got pieces of curvature coming from that function A, and I've got something which tells me about the background, gamma. So it's quite efficient in terms of, you know, doing things in generality. So you can see that the Riemann tensor and the Ricci tensor have the relevant symmetries. So that's the reason I've tried to do that in generality, is because I want to kind of come back and use it later when I sort of talk about more general solutions. But just very briefly, to finish off what I started, I'm going to go back to four dimensions, back to this wall, the energy momentum that we found, and just present what the solution is. In D equals 4, with a constant curvature space, I'm going to let my curvature of gamma be kappa over L squared. So what I then find is that GZZ has a curvature piece, something because gamma is like a de Sitter spacetime, since we're kind of running a bit late, I'm just going to kind of try and give you the key bullet points. This is what the gravity equation would be in general. What we found is in Minkowski space, phi prime squared equals v. So let me just look at what the typical coupling to gravity is given by this energy momentum tensor. It's sort of governed by this epsilon, which is 8 pi g eta squared. So if I look at 8 pi g v, for example, this is 8 pi g eta squared times order lambda eta squared when it's non-zero. So this is just the scale of the kink. And I could choose my definition of length to set it equal to 1. So this is really telling me about the gravitational strength. So if I take epsilon much less than 1, which is kind of saying that my wall is somewhat below the Planck scale, then it makes sense for me to expand my Einstein equations in powers of epsilon. So the background solution is the kink, i.e. tansch, for the scalar field, and then I use that background solution to calculate T, which then gives me my gravitational solution. Then we calculate our function A to order epsilon. So I'm just going to tell you that kappa is 1, L is 3 over 2 epsilon, and A is 1 minus epsilon So I've set root lambda eta to 1, and this is with the tansch solution. So basically what happens is I can find a gravitational solution. The only thing you might worry about is that that function A does tend to zero. So I do have a singularity in those coordinates. But this is not a physical singularity, which is odd, because you might expect it to be. But it's more like an event horizon. And in fact, I can change coordinates to show that outside the wall, space-time is flat. So I'm just going to put this down very quickly. So these would be new coordinates, and my space-time looks flat in those coordinates. And what sort of happened is that my wall is actually not infinite. My wall is actually now spherical. And what happens is it looks like I've taken Minkowski space, I've cut out a hyperboloid, I keep the inside, I take a second copy, and then I glue the two sides together. So what gravity has done is kind of automatically compactified the space. Okay, so I've run a lot over. So I'll stop there. I do not expect this to be at all clear because I realize I've rushed through it. We kind of will be coming back to some of these themes later. And this particular one of trying to look at global structures of space-times, this is actually quite a useful theme. And I mentioned with Dussiter space that it looked like a hyperboloid. So again, that's something that's familiar. So we can maybe follow that up either during a tutorial, but some of the messages I will come back to, but I better stop there and let the boards be cleaned.